Evening, everyone. Welcome to Peace Talks here at St. George's, Paddington Anglican. We begin our time together by acknowledging that we meet on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay our respects to all Eora elders past, present and future whose land was never ceded and whose customs continue to this day. My name is Joel Harrison. I'm your host for this evening. Our usual host, Dave Taylor, he's in a better place now. Namely, he's at home resting up. Now, what is Peace Talks? Our goal here at Peace Talks is to serve the community by being a site for necessary and illuminating conversations, drama, art, life. We believe that it is here in this church and churches like it that our vision begins to be restored, that we can begin with flailing hope to see rightly, to see justly, to see with God's own eyes. And so we think that this means the church can be and is a host. We host conversations and more that help us to see better. And we think that this means allowing for the speculative, the imaginative, and indeed sometimes subversive. Because we inhabit a faith, we trust that there is something true to be seen, to be heard, to be said. But we think of this more as a common quest. Our hope is to explore together what is personhood, how do we live in community, in our common home, this planet, what it means to live in right, equitable, just relationships. How do we see rightly in a world that often seems to want to diminish personhood, community, and dignity? And we think that there is great joy to be had in this. Pursuing truth, our tradition tells us, means delighting in something inexhaustibly, diversely, radically good. So I'm very glad you've come tonight. Thank you. We hope to think together deeply, but also feel deeply together, to scratch something of what I hope is a yearning you share, to set our sights a little higher and pursue, as it says on the tin, peace. Now, I'm also very glad tonight to welcome our speaker, a longtime friend of Peace Talks, Dr. Christopher Mays. Chris is a research fellow in the Alfred Deakin Institute at Deakin University and research affiliate in Sydney Health Ethics at the University of Sydney. He is supported in this by a DECRA, and that's academic speak for he's brilliant and he passes all the pub tests. He is the author of The Biopolitics of Lifestyle, Foucault, Ethics and Healthy Choices from Routledge in 2016, numerous articles, and many things you may have seen on sites like The Conversation. His forthcoming book is Unsettling Food Politics, Agriculture, Dispossession and Sovereignty in Australia with Roman and Littlefield. And in it, Chris examines contemporary political and ethical discourses of food and agriculture in Australia. He's traveled all the way from the Badlands of Victoria just to be with us. Right? Pretty much, yeah, good. And he'll be speaking for 30 minutes, and then we're going to have some question time and discussion, at which I should remind you that, as is ordinary here, we're recording the conversation. It's not on film this time. We're just being broadcast to a sound recording. But Chris will be speaking to us on the emergence of bioethics in Australia, contesting life, death. Please join me in welcoming back Chris.
Yeah, but I'm not really going to talk that much about the purpose of medicine. That's sort of implied. That can be part of the discussion afterwards. So yes, I hope that it will go for around 30 minutes. That's my anticipation. And then we can have some conversation and discussion afterwards. So this is part of a new project that I'm starting, looking at this area of bioethical research and debate in Australia that started around the 1980s. And I want to begin by sort of telling a story about how I think some of this beginning of bioethics in Australia started. So in April 1983, a wealthy Californian couple, Mario and Elsa Rios, died in a plane crash in the Andes in Chile. 12 months later, their unfortunate death soon came to occupy the attention of international media when it was discovered that they had two frozen embryos in Melbourne's Queen Victoria Medical Centre. In 1981, Mario and Elsa had travelled to Melbourne for fertility treatment with the world-leading team of researchers at Monash University, Queen Victoria Medical Centre, and Royal Women's Hospital. Three embryos were created. One was implanted at the time, and two were frozen for possible future use. Elsa Rios, however, suffered a miscarriage 10 days after the first embryo was implanted and died in her plane crash before being able to use the remaining two embryos. However, these, what came to be referred to as orphaned embryos, if implanted in a surrogate, so if implanted in another woman, had the potential to result in a live birth and would be heirs, or potential heirs after legal debate, to the Rios estate. This was an unprecedented and complex situation. As reported by the New York Times on June the 21st, 1984, the Australian authorities are also grappling with the moral and legal issues of what to do with the embryos. A government-appointed committee is studying the ethics of in vitro fertilisation and will make recommendations in July to the government. In a second New York Times article, Dr. Linda Moore, an embryologist at Queen Victoria Medical Centre, was quoted asking, "If the parents die, or they are separated, or they don't want their embryos, are they my responsibility? Can an embryo inherit things? I don't know what the answers are." Moore was not the only one asking questions without clear answers. The Victorian and federal governments were also concerned about the moral and legal status of embryos, as was the judiciary, university researchers, media, and the general public. However, it was unclear who was able to answer these questions. So my interest in revisiting this period is less about reigniting debates over the moral status and the legal status of embryos, but more about the emergence of these bioethical experts. So the speed with which reproductive technologies developed, in combination with the extraordinary circumstances of the Rios case, led to and motivated a spread or a proliferation of bioethical experts, advising the state, the university researchers, medical practitioners, and the wider public or publics on the moral status and the legal status of embryos. So for those of you who are perhaps not familiar with bioethics as a term, and you may think, well, what's the difference between bioethics and just general ethics in relation to medicine? I mean, there has been a long history of ethical concern about medicine. So Hippocrates with the Greeks, the Hippocratic Oath is often referred to as an example of the very first medical ethics, or Galen, a Roman physician, also had a lot of things to say about the way a doctor should practice and relate to their patients. And then speeding up to more contemporary times, often people talk about the Nuremberg Codes, following the revelation that Nazi doctors and scientists were involved in some very horrendous experiments. There's development of Nuremberg Codes about the way doctors should behave. Then there's also examples of Howard Beecher, an anthropologist in PNG, who came up with these ideas of, well, not ideas, but was aware of the way that anthropologists and scientists were going into places like Papua New Guinea and Africa and doing experiments without asking people whether they actually wanted these experiments done. So there is a long history of people thinking about, okay, how should doctors, how should scientists relate to patients and to human subjects? However, bioethics, I'm suggesting, emerges in the context of the development of biotechnologies or technological interactions with medical practice and medical research, which then also changes what we could think about as our human biography. So these bios, or life, our life stories, the way technology changes life, and the way that it changes medical practice. So I'm suggesting that with the radical, with the advancement of biotechnologies, there is this radical transformation of these relationships. So the beginning and ending of life, it's not so it's not as clear as to where they happen. Does the embryo, so the female egg and the male sperm coming together in a petri dish, does that mark the beginning of life? So previously that was not a possible thing to happen, even though there were extensive debates in the ancient world around when ensoulment happened in the womb. Was it at 40 days or 25 days? But in a petri dish, when you have the egg and the sperm coming together as the embryo, does that mark the beginning of life? Or going to the other end, does a still pink and warm body kept alive by machines sufficiently mark the end of life such that their organs can be removed to help save the life of another person? And then also the changing nature of medicine in combination with the huge investment into these technologies, with the increase of money to be made through the health system, doctors are increasingly becoming drawn into entrepreneurial activities, setting up their own practices, setting up their own clinics that use these technologies to both help people but also can make an extraordinary amount of money. So of course questions about the beginning and ending of life were discussed by the ancients, but I'm suggesting, and many others have, that technology has radically intensified those questions. New lines in the sand need to be drawn, and bioethicists emerge to draw those lines. So today, some of you may be aware or not, but there are over 200 health research ethics committees in Australia. Most major universities offer courses in bioethics or have research centres that are devoted to bioethics. Medical degrees, it's now compulsory to have ethics units in medical degrees. And bioethicists are often asked to come into the media domain and offer an expert opinion on matters of morality and the life sciences. So I'm focusing specifically on Australian bioethics, and in delivering the 1989 Boyer Lectures, philosopher Max Charlesworth noted that the contribution of Australian bioethics has been remarkable and taken as a whole superior to, and in a sense much more radical and imaginative than in most other countries. And perhaps he's been a little parochial, considering he was involved in bioethics at the time. Charles does point to the distinctive contribution of Australian bioethics in response to the advancement of reproductive technologies. The historical emergence of bioethics varies between countries and jurisdictions. So, for example, in the US, it emerged arguably in the 1960s in response to urgencies around the allocation of the newly developed dialysis machine. So if you've got five people who need dialysis and you've only got one machine that can keep them alive, how do we allocate? How do we choose who gets the dialysis machine? So there were a lot of committees that started to look at these questions. In Australia, bioethics emerged in the 1980s in response to the advancement of reproductive medicine. This history of the advancement of bioethics, wherever really it's told, but in Australia it's the same, it's often told in this linear and triumphant narrative. A new medical technology promises great hope to vulnerable people. Old authorities block the way and prevent those in need from accessing this technology. Old authorities are overcome by new ideas put forward by those with clear eyes and big hearts. And today we stand in the enlightened present that confirms the old authorities were wrong and the new ones are right. This narrative, or a version of it, is found in the introduction of many bioethics textbooks. It's reflected, for instance, in the title of Peter Singer's Rethinking Life and Death, The Collapse of Our Traditional Ethics. And the cover also has a short paragraph, A New Copernican Revolution in the Offing, one that challenges the basic precepts and codes of ethics that have previously governed life and death. This triumphant narrative is mirrored, however, by a doom and gloom narrative, whereby the power and success of medical technologies will be our Promethean undoing. So in the foreword to Daniel Overduin's and John Fleming's 1982 book, Life in a Test Tube, Dr. E.G. Cleary describes in ominous tones the advances in science, the major revolution in social behaviour, immense power of mass communication, and how the combined effect has removed the church from its place as our accepted guide and left a vacuum that has not been filled by any alternative source of ethical guidance. So there are many approaches to examine the history of bioethics in Australia and many events that could be discussed. However, tonight I just want to briefly touch on three areas, and then I may, depend how I feel, end with some speculative hypotheses about where this could go, but I'm very keen to hear your thoughts on it in general. So I'm firstly going to talk about bioethics and its relationship to science and the public, then the institutionalisation and marginalisation of certain voices in bioethics, and finally, authority of bioethical experts. So who gets to speak as a bioethicist, even if we don't know what one is. So as noted, the development and clinical application of in vitro fertilisation techniques in the late 1970s and the early 1980s established bioethics in Australia. The first IVF baby was born in the UK in 1978. However, significant developments in IVF from 1970 to 1985 came predominantly from Australia. This was largely due to the pioneering work of Carl Wood and Dr. Ellen Trounson. Wood and Trounson led a team of Melbourne-based researchers from Monash University, Royal Women's Hospital, and Queen Victoria Hospital, and were considered, according to John Leeton, the historian of that period, who also worked with them, so a little bit conflicted, they were considered the early intellectual driving force of IVF in Australia. And this research led to a series of world firsts in IVF research and its clinical application, as well as the world first legislation to regulate IVF practices. So the advancement of reproductive technologies provoked ethical questions about the beginning of life and then the use of embryos that were left over in biomedical research. So researchers and the public were anxious about the ramification of this research, and it led to the establishment initially of the Waller Committee. So established on the 11th of March 1982, the Victorian Attorney General and Minister of Health, they established the Waller Committee to investigate the social, ethical and legal issues surrounding IVF in Victoria. And the committee was chaired by Professor Lewis Waller, hence the name, Waller Committee. And it also had Francis Harmon, Reverend Dr. Francis Harmon, a moral theologian of the Catholic Church, Mrs. Jasna Hay, a former teacher with interests in migrant welfare, Reverend Dr. John Henley, a lecturer in Christian ethics at Melbourne College of Divinity, Ms. Eva Lerner, a social worker from La Trobe University, Dr. James McDonald, a GP with experience in obstetrics and gynaecology, Ms. Lynette Opus, a professor in family law, Professor Priscilla Kincaid-Smith from medicine in University of Melbourne, and Professor Roger Pepperell, professor of obstetrics and gynaecology. Now, I'm just reading out these names to give a sense of where the professions these people were coming from to decide these questions around the moral status of embryos. And also, I think it's important that the gender makeup, whether they're based in universities, Catholics, lecturing Christian ethics, etc. So between 1982 and 1986, they wrote a number of reports and made recommendations that shaped the world-first Victorian legislation on IVF and then also surrogacy. And they gave an initial recommendation to the Victorian government as to what to do with the Rios embryos. Earlier than this, however, the advances in reproductive medicine led to the first bioethics centre in Australia in 1980, the Monash Centre for Human Bioethics. The former director, Justin Oakley, describes how Monash University, this is a quote from Justin Oakley, Monash University, whose scientists helped pioneer IVF techniques, set up the Monash Bioethics Centre to promote research on these and related ethical issues. The centre even employed an ethicist with the title Community Liaison Officer to run community workshops on ethical implications of the new reproductive technologies and to encourage discussion at the grassroots level. I mean, for those of us who are in universities, it's quite a different position to perhaps today what would be around, considering the tightening of various purse strings. But it's an interesting position. Peter Singer, founder and director of the Monash Bioethics Centre, also developed close ties with the Monash biomedical researchers and sought to educate the public about new technologies. So Alan Trounson, one of the founders of the reproductive medicine program at Monash, said of Peter Singer, "I had to sort myself out in the early days, just like anyone who works in a new area involving something like human embryos. If we hadn't had Peter Singer around in those days, I think we might not have pursued some things to the extent that we have." The close involvement of bioethics or bioethicists with medical researchers and associated industries has provoked questions as to whether these relations weaken the capacity for bioethicists to provide a critical voice. So this is more recently, some people have been questioning whether such close relationships is a great idea. So sociologist Nicholas Rose suggests that bioethics developed out of an alliance between, and this is a quote from him, "those who want or need an ethical warrant for their commercial or scientific activities and those who see here a potential locus for grants, recognition and professional vocation and a public role." The pub test. This needs further examination, I would suggest. However, the current point, or the point I'm trying to make, is that Australian bioethics initially grew out of these alliances with university research and the administration of hospitals in response to public controversies surrounding reproductive technologies. However, there was also a reaction to these developments in the university. Establishment of bioethics centres associated with dioceses, particularly Catholic dioceses, as well as conferences by other interested academics, clergy, scientists, lawyers, and laity. So the very first, from what I have been able to find so far, bioethics conference happened in 1981. The booklet's from 1982, just that date there. The Healthcare in Crisis, a Bioethical Perspective. And that was organised by Thomas Connolly at the University of New South Wales in 1981. And then there's Bioethical Decision-Making, Bioethical Issues was a conference held in Adelaide in, I think, 1984. And then the Sydney Adventist Hospital started holding bioethics conferences from 1986 through to 1998. So there are some developments that were happening outside or tangentially to these more academic philosophy-based conferences. Which brings me to the institutionalisation and marginalisation idea. So what voices were brought into various governing bodies and institutions and what voices remained perhaps on the periphery? So while there was public debate over who had the authority to make decisions about moral questions regarding the beginning and end of life, there were also legal and bureaucratic processes that needed to be addressed. Bioethics increasingly became institutionally embedded in committees advising on public policy, clinical practice and medical research. So in 1982, the National Health and Medical Research Council established the Medical Research Ethics Committee to ensure funded research adhered to ethical principles in human experimentation. 6 years later, in 1988, the Australian Health Ministers Conference, so all the state government health ministers and the federal minister, established the National Bioethics Consultative Committee, or the NBCC. The purpose of this committee was to, quote, "address ethical, legal and social issues arising from reproductive technology, biomedical and health-related research, scientific and medical technology, and the provision and delivery of health services." The NBCC was a multidisciplinary committee. I won't go through all the names of the people, but it was comprised of 12 members from all states of Australia, And the disciplines included law, sociology, philosophy, nursing, science and technology, policy, theology, medical research practice, and consumers. That good old profession of consumers. So in 1991, the health minister felt that the Medical Research Ethics Committee and the National Bioethics Consultative Committee had significant overlap, so decided to merge the two and establish the Australian Health Ethics Committee. And their terms of reference were to advise the Council on Health Ethics, develop guidelines, promote community debate, monitor and advise the working of institutional ethics committees, monitor international developments in ethics and ethics committees. And I'm saving you from a lot of the other detail around this to suggest here that there is a certain sort of bureaucratic tediousness to a lot of the development of these committees, and there are different layers of committees addressing different levels of state and federal policy. So as mentioned earlier, there are now currently over 200 health research ethics committees in Australia, and most major universities offer these courses in bioethics, and that there's a compulsory element in certain in medical degrees. In addition, there are conferences and journals, a proliferation of this bioethical discourse that I will not go into further tonight. However, the public nature of bioethics disputes and the engagement of academic bioethicists in the public sphere raise questions as to who qualifies to speak as a bioethicist. And so not all voices were included in the same manner. So here, for instance, is the logo of FinRage, the Feminist International Network of Resistance to Reproductive and Genetic Engineering. So feminists have provided an important critical voice that often oscillates from inside and outside the bioethics camp. So feminist critiques were influential in response to the development of reproductive technologies in Australia. These critiques often point to wider social implications of bioethical technologies, the institutional power structures that dismiss the experience of women, and political and economic forces that reinforce positions of privilege. So here are some interesting newspaper articles. The one at the top is actually a much bigger article than the one on the left. I find that important to point out. Just because. That is reporting on the Australian and New Zealand Association for the Advancement of Science Conference. And so this was a report in the Sydney Morning Herald on the 19th of May, 1984. And it was questioning whether this was a serious science conference or not anymore. And the question was, or it was saying that too many people from women's studies, from philosophy, from the humanities were coming to these conferences and presenting on their particular research relating to science, and it wasn't really seen as sort of hard science or the advancement of science anymore, but more these people with their esoteric concerns about things. So the feminist critique of reproductive medicine drew attention to areas that were largely ignored by sort of mainstream ethicists and scientists. And the article on the left is from the Sydney Morning Herald on the 25th of May, reporting back onto the conference about a clash that occurred. It's sort of wrongfully titled Test Tube Doctors Clash at Meeting. So one, it was Carl Wood, who I referred to earlier as one of the founding people in reproductive medicine in Australia, and Robin Rowland, who was a women's studies scholar and a critic of reproductive technologies. And it's reporting about the way that Robin Rowland was sort of questioning about whose interests are really served by some of these early developments in IVF, particularly the program happening through Monash and at Melbourne. So the feminist critique of reproductive medicine drew attention to areas that were largely ignored. For example, since the mid-1980s, feminist bioethicists recognised that there was a need to question the influence of commercial values on the motives and ethics of clinicians. Robin Rowland argued that IVF physicians look, and this is a quote from her, IVF physicians look less altruistic as their efforts to generate profits intensified, and query the secrecy over a new commercial enterprise. So as early as 1985, Robin Rowland was questioning the setup of a company within Monash University. It's still vague and secretive, so I'm not entirely sure. Joel, you're a lawyer. Does that cover me from the recording if I get sued by Monash University? And this is a quote then from Rowland from an article she was writing about this relationship between the creation of a IVF company within the context of Monash University and Women's Hospital, saying, "The details of this company, nearly 2 years after negotiations began, have still not been released to either the University Council or the public who funds the institution. The shroud of secrecy around this IVF company has been seen as a threat to academic freedom, to scientific scrutiny, to public access to state-sponsored research information, and of course to public control and scrutiny. Such a collaboration between research and commercial interests uses women in essentially experimental program and asks the participants and the public to underwrite the expense so that the researchers can enter into commercial contracts for profit." That's the end of her quote. So in 2014, to fast forward, Monash IVF floated on the stock market for over $300 million. Yet Rowland's concerns have been dismissed as unfounded. In writing a history of IVF in Australia, John Leighton, who I mentioned earlier, who wrote this history and was part of Carl Wood's team at Monash, in his history written in 2013, characterised Rowland's criticisms as extreme and misguided. Although there was public support for IVF as a remedy for infertility, there was also concern about the moral status of unused embryos. So for those who are unaware, often there needs to be the creation of more embryos to be implanted in a woman, and then there are embryos left over that there's a question mark as to what will happen to those embryos. And so people were keen to do some research on them to see if we could discover sort of the development of certain genetic diseases and other aspects of the development of early life. So there was a concern about the moral status of these unused embryos, the implications for women and its potential to unravel the fabric for society, no longer based on traditional practices of reproduction, was also a concern that people had. So for instance, if we could produce more people without the need of mum and dad. So the early laws were always about married couples can access reproductive technologies, whereas people who are single or in same-sex relations or in de facto relations could not access these technologies. So there was a concern that IVF may unravel the fabric of society that is brought up through the unit of a nuclear family. So critical responses to IVF research and practice came from religious organisations, primarily Catholic, but there were also these feminist critiques as well. And according to Rowland, techniques of IVF are a double-edged sword that may provide some hope for some women, but, to quote Rowland, can and will and are being used to reinforce the oppression of women. Rowland argues that medical history is filled with examples of technologies and practices intended to liberate women, yet do the opposite. Rowland and others questioned whether IVF would be the continuation of this trend. So that's sort of the feminist critique, and then which is sort of on the side of what I would suggest is the more institutionalised bioethics that gets institutionalised in the committees to sort of decide certain forms of practice. And another one that sort of runs alongside this is a powerful, yet not institutionalised in the same way as other forms, which is the Catholic, primarily Catholic, but other forms of Christian critique or Christian bioethics. So in the US, which I think is an interesting counterexample, Catholic bioethics emerged in the context of the university, and many of the leading bioethicists had theological as well as philosophical training. So some of these names won't mean anything to you. To some of you, they will. But, you know, Paul Ramsey, Joseph Fletcher, James Childress, Tristram Inglehart, and Albert Johnson, all significant figures in the history of bioethics in the US, but also were coming, at least initially for some of them, from theological backgrounds as well as philosophical backgrounds. Yet in Australia, there seems to be a great divide between the so-called secular and faith-based bioethics. Rather than entering the university, the theological bioethics often occurred in the context of dioceses or faith-based hospitals such as St. Vincent's in Fitzroy and Darlinghurst, the Martyr in Brisbane, or the San in Wirunga. However, a strange and strategic alliance occurred between the radical feminists and the Catholics. Following the death, and this can be seen in an obituary following the death of Nicholas Tonti Filippini in 2014. And he was a leading Catholic voice in bioethic debates. And a number of radical feminists, including Robin Rowland, left notes on an obituary published on the ABC Religion and Ethics website. And Renata Klein, who was a professor in women's studies at Deakin University, wrote, "Nick Tonti Filippini was a good, kind and profoundly ethical man, and he never minded being in bed with us radical feminists. Nor did we. He showed the world that you can engage with vitally important topics in a mutually respectful way and agree to disagree on some issues. He was a wonderful supporter of our critical analyses of IVF, surrogacy, cloning and many other topics radical feminists have remained engaged with since the early 1980s. We learned a great deal from his unwavering commitment to staying true to his beliefs and admired him for it." So I think that this is an interesting example of a sort of strange alliance that developed as a result of some of these bioethical debates and the introduction of these technologies. Radical feminists on the one hand and sort of conservative Catholics on the other. However, unlike the feminists, Catholics did have large institutional home and support. In addition to university-based bioethics, a number of centres affiliated with the Roman Catholic Church have been established in Australia. Like university centres, there is a strong emphasis on advocacy and public education. The Queensland Bioethics Centre was established by the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Brisbane in 1981 with the aim to provide an up-to-date resource library, expert advice, and representation and education on bioethical questions. So this is to say that I think whether secular or religious, there's this emphasis on trying to focus on the public. So here's the Melbourne-based one, Pope John Paul II Institute. But the Catholic bioethics sort of emerges as well at the same time as the sort of antithesis of sort of the secular one. So this is I find it's a bit of a funny editorial in the Journal of Bioethical Inquiry about the Roman Catholic Church and the repugnant conclusion, which is talking about the idea that, or has the thought experiment of, if the Roman Catholic Church controlled the whole world, there was no Protestant Reformation, there was no sort of enlightenment in according to this narrative, then this would be a sort of terrible draconian place to live in. This is sort of, I think, the bioethical imagination, or some, the imagination of some bioethicists has sort of the Catholic worldview as being looming large as the dystopian potential. So, and I think this is particularly played out in Australia, where there is an antagonism between academic bioethics and faith-based, especially Catholic bioethics. So bioethics in the university context has adopted more of a Rawlsian approach to faith-based approaches. So the idea that there should be just a public reason, the Rawlsian approach that we should be all just be able to talk a language that we all agree on and everyone just keep their faith and their ideas private to themselves. Some commentators consider the involvement of faith-based bioethics in the public sphere to be cause for suspicion, while others, so Max Charlesworth, for example, recognised a place for religious perspectives in a liberal society, but he ultimately suggests that personal autonomy needs to take primacy. So although there is a difference between university-based and religious-affiliated bioethics centres, the overlap is this objective to reach out to a public. So whether secular or religious, bioethics has considered public engagement through education and advocacy to be a key characteristic. Yet I think one person's public engagement is another one's propaganda. One person's utopia is the other one's dystopia. So public bioethics often leads to one group fomenting a moral panic, while the other tells these utopic tales of a disease-free future. So in his work on moral panic, Stanley Cohen writes that the moral panic is transparent. Anyone can see what's happening, but also opaque. Accredited experts must explain the perils hidden behind the superficially harmless. A similar dynamic operates, I think, in bioethics, except perhaps it's inverted, where certain publics or members of the medical community see what's happening in shifts relating to, say, embryos and human life, yet it is the bioethical experts who are able to truly interpret and understand the shifting reality. Often, and more often than not, to calm the fears and to suggest that concern and the panic is overblown. A philosopher critical of the rise of bioethical experts is Raymond Gaita. While he believes philosophers should engage in moral and political issues, he contends that they ought not to appeal to the authority they have by virtue of being competent or even eminent in a subject. So while with Peter Singer in mind, Gaita writes, having a chair in practical ethics does not qualify anyone to sit on committees which decide who amongst us should be killed if the going gets tough. According to Gaita, the status of academic philosophy or bioethics is not privileged in matters of life and death. However, the proliferation of these bioethics committees and special advisory panels to government has served to establish academic bioethics as a legitimate and authoritative perspective on matters of life and death. Thus, whilst bioethicists may not have authority by virtue of their capacity or otherwise to read and apply the work of Immanuel Kant or Jeremy Bentham, some have been granted authority by government agencies, medical community, and certain sections of the media. I would contend that the authority of bioethics, however, is primarily derived from its relationship to medical science, and that when this relationship is tested, i.e. when bioethicists call into question medical practice or research, the authority of the bioethicist dissipates. So take a modern example of Steven Pinker saying that bioethicists should get out of the way of recent genetic research in relation to CRISPR. He says in the Boston Globe, the primary goal of today's bioethics can be summarised in a single sentence, get out of the way. And I think that that's a similar sentiment perhaps to that 1984 article about whether women's studies and philosophy were just getting in the way of science and what was going on there. So Australian politicians, however, on the more conservative side, so you have this progressive side who are saying bioethics is getting in the way by slowing up medical research. Then on the other side, you can have some more conservative voices. So Australian politicians have also criticised bioethics and bioethicists. So Kevin Andrews, in his maiden speech to Parliament on the 5th of September 1991, said, my major interest in recent years has been in health law and bioethics, which include areas of national concern. Of bioethics, I will only say now that I regret that the Minister of Health, Housing and Community Services has apparently ignored wider community concerns by establishing exclusively within the scientific community a new Australian Health Ethics Committee with some of the same personnel from the widely discredited National Bioethics Consultative Committee. Appropriate regulation in sensitive and complex areas such as reproductive technology requires a system which is accountable and inspires public confidence. The current proposal will achieve neither. Thus, bioethics, or the authority of bioethics, is contested by a number of voices, especially the more, what I would say, polemic manifestations of bioethics. So the Peter Singer versus Nicholas Tonti Filippini, they would have debates in the 1980s about these issues. They would, you know, at times would be civil and shed light on an issue, at other times would be quite ferocious. And you see contemporary examples of this around various issues where there's a very polemic, divided debate over an issue where there's a lot of speaking past each other. And so I think the authority of that bioethics gets contested. However, the bioethics in its more mundane form of ethics committees, of mandatory units for medical students, of informed consent forms that people just sign on when they're at a hospital or somewhere and they're not really paying perhaps too much attention. I think that more sort of mandatory influence of bioethical thinking is increasingly pervasive as a regulatory authority. So for instance, I, in doing this project on bioethics, had to go through a whole range of ethical committees at my university to allow me to interview bioethicists about controversial subjects. And then there was a concern that I might upset them by talking to them about controversial things, and whether there was needing to be a greater oversight to talk about these matters. And it goes on. But you're sort of trapped in an institution, and you can question it as much as you like, but you then get caught in this sort of Kafka-esque maze. And then they just start thinking you're being facetious and a pain in the neck. So you go along with it. And that's often what happens with, say, informed consent as a very rudimentary form of these sorts of things. You get off, you're at the doctor's office, you sign the informed consent thing. You could go away and read it, but you never have any time to do that. Then are you going to choose somebody else as your doctor? And it goes on. So in summary, and so this is to conclude, one of the points that can be taken from this history of bioethics in Australia is that it emerged in the context of controversy and drama of, say, the Rios case, but quickly was integrated into bureaucratic mechanisms. So during the 1980s, bioethics emerged as a discourse through which scientists, medical practitioners, ethicists, and the wider public tried to make sense of advances in biotechnologies. While feminist and religious, primarily Catholic, voices critiqued many of these advances in relation to reproductive medicine, the government governance of medical research and practice has largely occurred, don't need to see Kevin anymore, has largely occurred through bureaucratic channels, so committees, panels, and so forth. The authority of bioethics comes less from the persuasiveness of arguments in the public sphere, not that such things are irrelevant, but through the authority derived and expressed in institutional contexts of hospitals, clinics, research universities, etc. So perhaps rather than characterising Australian bioethics as radical and imaginative, which Max Charlesworth did, it could perhaps more appropriately be described as bureaucratic and pragmatic. So, some of you may be wondering, but some of you may have forgot, what happened to the Rios embryos? So the Waller committee recommended that the embryos be destroyed and said to the Victorian Parliament that that should be the appropriate course of action. However, the Victorian Parliament rejected that suggestion, and on the 3rd of December 1987, Sydney Morning Herald reported that the Victorian government is to announce today the fate of the Rios embryos 6 years after they were frozen in an in vitro fertilisation program in Melbourne, and more than 4 years after their parents died in an air crash. State Health Minister Mr. David Wallace said that one possibility was to give the embryos to another couple in the program. So, the day after, the Sydney Morning Herald reported that the Victorian Health Minister announced that the embryos are to be implanted in a married woman who is infertile and who has been in the IVF program for over 12 months. Carl Wood, the professor involved with the program at Monash, suggested that the embryos would have about a 1% chance of survival. In the meantime, in this sort of 6-year gap, the Californian Supreme Court had ruled that if the embryos developed and were born, they would not be the heirs to the Rios estate. This article, I don't think you can see it up there, oh, you probably can, concludes that the health minister said that if a suitable recipient was not found, the embryos would be stored indefinitely. And that is all that we know. Thank you. And just in case you thought I was speaking on behalf of the Australian government, I was not. Another sort of bureaucratic procedure. Yeah, so any questions or comments? Yes, thank you for the comment and question. And I think that that's an important point to make as well about biotechnology being concerned with so many other areas, because Alan Trounson, who was one of the leaders in this area, was coming more from an animal husbandry, veterinary science background, and that there is this continual interrelationship between what goes on in sort of animal sciences, soil sciences, etc., and at a, yes, certainly not the specific level, but it is always interesting and important, I think, to see the way there's this interaction between practices. So for instance, and this isn't something that is, so to lead on to your next question, that there are already sheep that have been, lambs that have been kept in a artificial womb, external to, you know, any kind of sheep body, kept in a plastic bag. And that's sort of some of the critiques that Jania Correa and people were making in the sort of late 70s, early 80s about the development of reproductive medical technologies, that soon the female body will be superfluous to reproduction. And everyone was suggesting that that's crazy and science fiction-like. And that now, you know, that in animal sciences and breeding, they are developing these artificial wombs that they can breed a lamb in, and that could develop further into human areas. I mean, in bioethics today, I think it is more on the, I would suggest, there's one camp who are interested in the sort of science fiction element of artificial intelligence, robotics, superhumans, can this new CRISPR gene editing technology turn everyone into Arnold Schwarzenegger? I mean, they're always very masculine images, like, because they're very often white dudes from Oxford talking about how we can turn, I can go into become a huge, strong man. And then the other area of bioethics, which I think I'm more familiar with, are people who are dealing with the more mundane day-to-day, and I would say, questions that we would encounter with, say, practices of informed consent and those sorts of things. So more technical legal issues.
Chris, I just wanted to bring up, as a bioethicist, what are the ethical issues in regards to the perennial question of euthanasia? Someone given, should be avail of the opportunity to end one's life if, when the going gets rough. If they are, agonizing over a terminal illness. It's just that there was a case, I don't know whether the audience is aware of, back in the 1980s, the ex-governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, Sir John Phillips, took his own life. And he was aged around about in his mid-70s. Even though he didn't have any terminal illnesses, but he just didn't want to go old, and when you go old, you get a lot of illnesses. So he just decided to take his own life. So versus someone who might be having a good, really good, going through a rough patch. I want to do that in contrast with cryogenics. Okay, someone trying to, you know, is available to people. You need to be pretty well off. I think it takes about $500,000
yeah.
to freeze your body, and sometime in the future, when the medical technology is available, you can revive yourself. I just wanted to know, as a bioethicist, you know, what are the ethical implications of those two, euthanasia vis-a-vis cryogenics?
Well, there are a lot of ethical implications with both of them. There's a good novel by Don DeLillo, Zero K, I think it is, which is set and based around this idea of a son finding out that his very wealthy father has set up one of these sort of cryogenic facilities in the desert somewhere. Look, I don't have a lot to say about either of the. I think that the economics behind a lot of those decisions are an interesting, and the class dimensions to what shapes those sorts of decisions, and then reflecting questions of having power and autonomy and wanting to completely be in control of one's life, I suppose would be the broad reference points that I would take in thinking about that to start off with. But there's a lot to say.
I realize you've concentrated on reproductive technology.
Yeah.
But I think bioethics is, or ethical problems with medical technology goes way beyond that.
Yeah.
In particular, let me give you the biggest bioethical problem I know of, which I've never received a satisfactory answer, which involves the breast cancer gene BRCA1.
Yep.
As you may know, if a woman has mutation in this gene, she has a 70% chance, absolutely 7 women in 10, of developing either breast cancer or ovarian cancer in her lifetime.
Mm.
The problem arises that genetic clinics that look at these families, inevitably, when they look at 2 or 3 generations, identify women who have never shown any interest in genetic testing. The clinic will identify women who assuredly have a mutation in the gene.
Mm.
And the initial ethical problem, and therefore a 70% chance of developing a lethal malignancy and prophylactic bilateral mastectomy is the common way out of this. The ethical problem begins with the notion of notifying such a woman, as I said, who'd never had any initiative.
Yep.
And the initial simplistic thought was to send a letter saying you may care to attend a cancer hereditary clinic for testing. The problem is that when you send such a letter to a woman who's done absolutely nothing, when that woman opens the letter, it doesn't matter what she does. If she fails to notify her health insurance that she has information concerning her health that may possibly affect her insurance policy, she is in breach and her health assurance is null.
Mm.
And therefore, the clinic, fearing that, that consequence, so far as I know, do not notify women, despite the fact you would say these women face a quasi-death sentence, even because the compromise to the health insurance that they're then, unless they notify, doesn't matter what they do, the moment they open that letter, they have received information concerning their health.
Yeah.
So so far as I know, I've never heard a good elucidation of the bioethics that solves that particular problem.
Mm.
But the challenge to me, it seems, is that there are bioethical problems that we hear about, but we don't hear so much is definitive criteria that allows the community or allow bioethicists, I don't know which, to solve the problem.
Yeah. And I think that those sorts of questions are ones that, not that question in particular, but those is what I was alluding to about how, you know, roughly there's the two camps, the one who want to talk about sort of AI robots coming to kill us all, or the ones who are talking about some of these questions around, you know, population screening and sort of a bit more seemingly mundane, but actually do have real world immediate consequences for people's lives. And I mean, this isn't my area, but there are, Byron, I think, is going to, do you have an opinion on that?
Seems to be another application of the dangers of having a capitalist health system.
Yeah.
You know, just like you were referring to IVF centres being run for profit and the
yep.
compromise in the doctor's impartiality and the care that they're giving to the couples coming to see them. The simple solution is to have universal health care that isn't compromised by gaining new information.
Yeah.
Simple.
Yeah. Yes, when I mean that's the other aspect. Like when money gets involved in health, sort of it's very these questions get exposed. Where if the money wasn't present, would not, and that cuts across in so many different aspects of health. Yeah. There are national laws and international laws that cover that, and then there is UNESCO in relation to the UN has like an international bioethics committee which gives some advisory guidelines around certain issues, but with the couple in Thailand that sort of is I think comes into more sort of domestic laws. You know, there's similar things in relation to organ transplants and the way that it's illegal to sell someone your organ in Australia, but then it's also illegal to go somewhere else and buy an organ from somebody, but then what do you do when they come back with the organ in them? And that they need continual medical treatment, so if you criminalise it too heavily or enforce that law too strongly, then they don't seek the medical treatment. You know, so I think with many of these sorts of issues, I know I just threw in organ transplantation as just to get things more complicated. It sometimes enforcing a law can then have further detrimental and ethical implications. So with, say, it's with the abandonment of a child in Thailand or the non-claiming of a child in Thailand, there are some legal implications. I'm not a lawyer. I barely claim to be a bioethicist, so I'm a historian as of tonight. And so I think in those situations, yes, there are international and domestic laws that can come into effect, and there are international and domestic ethical guidance that can come into effect. In relation to question one, yes, I think the Bible. One thing that interests me and one thing that I'm keen to look at further is how different passages from the Bible are used. There are certain sort of memes, sounds a bit too trivial, but you know, like you knitted me together in my mother's womb is something that is used a lot in, say,
Classicus.
Sorry?
Classical
yes, in bioethical sort of Christian bioethical literature. And I think that there needs care, theological care, in how those, particularly taking something from the Psalms, where it's sort of a poetry genre, to then be used as a hard and fast rule, either in a legal or an ethical context, I think, for me, is a problematic approach. So I suppose, care is the way that I would approach that interrelationship. Does that satisfy you, Darcy? Yeah. It's a tricky question. I think I'm still thinking through a lot of that for myself. But that first one in relation to the way certain poetic uses of the Bible to then create a strong ethical principle, I find quite, I personally find that inappropriate way to go about things.
This kind of follows up. I was intrigued by that relationship between the conservative Catholic guy, Nick
Tonti Filippini.
Thank you. And the radical feminist.
Yep.
And the sense that there was a mutual respect, even collaboration at some point.
Yep.
So it's the question, I guess, of shared language in which to do that, because the sort of time period you've been talking about, I guess we've also seen somewhat of a collapse in any kind of public consensus around morality, ethics as well.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is for you, as a bioethicist but also a person of Christian faith,
mm-hmm.
is this just one of those instances where you've got to be bilingual, or is there the possibility, I guess particularly those of us who are not bioethicists, is there a shared language? Like, what? How do we actually start to have a more respectful and collaborative conversation like was hinted at? Do we need to become bilingual, or is there a possibility of a shared discourse in these sort of...
I think bilingual in the sense that you do understand the language and the positions that others are coming from, as opposed to creating some kind of hybrid language. I also think there needs to be an attempt to find a greater appreciation of where the other person is coming from in what are their ethical and ontological commitments, how do they see the reality and the makeup of the world, and are they coming at that from a sincere perspective? So, for instance, this is still being recorded, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I was speaking to somebody who was talking to me about, say, for instance, Peter Singer, talking to them about the effect that some of the sort of very negative protests and things like that were having on him. And I think suggesting that even though there was this very polemic, sort of at times controversial, engagement of what he was saying, and he certainly was contributing to some of this, that ultimately there was a deeper ethical commitment to what he was trying to achieve. I think trying to take out some and deflate some of the rhetoric seems to be a key approach in these sorts of debates. And yeah, trying to understand the language and the perspectives that others are coming from. Do you have anything you'd like to say?
It made me think of, you mentioned old white men at Oxford, and immediately I think Julian Savulescu and the UHERO Institute, and I think that they are fundamentally, radically wanting to be post-human and radically utilitarian,
mm-hmm.
and radically and seemingly rabidly anti-Catholic, but
mm-hmm.
not just anti-religious. And so just to build on Jeff's point, you sort of think it's very hard to think of that in any other terms and almost this is the argument that is to be defeated.
Yep.
But I was going to build on that. You said, you know, my point on this actually was that you were saying a more materialist history, right? The technology drives us and so on. Now, I thought that as someone in the university now, it's so easy to take your analysis and map it onto the things that are happening. You know, so what are the areas that money gets poured into universities and suddenly people build research careers out of that? Absolutely. And that's just like, it just makes me shudder and so on, right? But at the same time, I was thinking, it's not wholly material then, because you think about these figures and the technology that they're talking about, and you even mentioned yourself, their emphasis on personal autonomy, for example, or their emphasis on a certain kind of utilitarian ethic or so on. So there seems to be something about the embedding of the philosophical view into this technology and so on. And even just the idea that philosophy itself is fragmented now, or academics. We're not just an academic now, we are a bioethicist. We are an analytical philosopher in the tradition of X. We are, you know, this
That's, so it seems that it's more, you know, there's the technology, but there's also radically something, the fusing of that with, you know, it's like an idealist and a materialist thing going, I don't know, something like that. That means if you're going to contest this, you have to also talk about it in that sort of way as well, maybe. Or no? Yes?
I would say from the point about Julian Savulescu and that area, to go back to what Jeff was saying, I think there's also a need to allow people to come from their own, like to at least on first encounter, give them the grace to see where they're coming from. So I think, for instance, some people, you can, it happens on both sides. So there is a suggestion that if you're coming from a faith-based perspective, then you are automatically, you're going to sign up to these sorts of things. Likewise, if you're coming from a radical utilitarian perspective, you're going to be signed up to these sorts of things. Whereas I think that there is there's a whole range of nuance on both sides, or even if both sides can be talked about. So for instance, in 1983, there's a sort of volume of Christian ethicists' response to test tube babies, in which Michael Hill, the Anglican Christian ethicist, Sydney Anglican, basically comes to the conclusion that Christians engaging, or anyone engaging with IVF, is an okay thing to be engaged with. That's very much simplifying his you know, essay. Then the very next essay is another former Anglican minister who goes on this whole screed about how infertility is the result of promiscuity and sinful conduct and all of that sort of stuff. So you could read that essay and think, well, all Anglicans and all you know, Christians have this very negative view both of IVF and then also infertility is the result of female promiscuity. And so I think on the other side, and back to this sort of more broader discourse ethics of seeing that there are different types of utilitarians, there are different types of this, there are different types of that. I think fragmentation within the university and then within bioethics is another huge issue. And that's all I've got to say about that. So, sorry, your first question was whether Australia is still at the vanguard?
Yes.
Of bioethics?
Thinking globally, I'm just curious.
Well, I think, and this relates to a number of the different questions throughout the night, of the relationship between bioethics. Like, can bioethics be at a vanguard unless there is a biomedical research that is at the vanguard? And so maybe the success, quote-unquote, of bioethics committees of the 1980s to, in some people's view, restrain or regulate certain biomedical technologies and developments of, has then meant that those questions are not as pertinent. I think it's increasingly... I think part of this project will be looking at the globalisation. So, increasingly, we are no longer, you know, what medical technology developments somewhere else in the world become ethical questions for here. So if, and particularly with what they talk about as medical tourism, people being able to move around the place. And I think bioethics is becoming increasingly fragmented in this way that I don't think we have or we'll see the same way that there was, you know, the guru, whether it's sort of Paul Ramsey in the 1960s and 70s in the US, or Jim Childress or Peter Singer in Australia, where there's the one guy, usually, who is able to think ethically about all of these issues. Now they're such fine-tuned problems that people then are able, are trying to think about. So I don't know. I'd probably say no, just because I'm, you know, un-Australian. and in relation to the makeup, yeah, well, now the NHNMRC has regulations around the representation of committees, so clergy are still involved and certain lay members of the community, etc. Consumers. They're full of professional consumers.
I said it.